Okay, great. So today's August 30th, 2017. I'm Rick Hansen. And yeah, thanks for closing the door. That'll be great. Recently, we've been exploring mindfulness and relationships. And then very recently, I've been raising the topic of forgiveness. Two kinds of forgiveness. I think there's a full pardon where we really wipe the slate clean. And then there's sort of a lower bar, what I call a disentangled forgiveness, where we're not really ready to give the person a full pardon, but we don't want to carry around resentments about it or vengeful fantasies or ill will. Right? And then last week, I talked about one of the hardest people in the world to forgive, yourself. And that opened up a big conversation about it. So I'd like to continue on that topic and enter it with an emphasis on self-acceptance and why that can be hard and what to do about it. And then open it up, as usual, for comments, discussion, questions, and so forth. So to forgive ourselves, in some ways, it must involve some kind of acceptance of who we are rather than an aversion or punishing attack on who we are. And Tara Brach, for example, has a beautiful book, her first book called Radical Acceptance, that gets at some of this material. It's a very deep topic. We could spend considerable time with it. It also opens up questions about how do we both accept what is, while at the same time, based on benevolence, compassion, kindness, morality, wisdom, make efforts to help what is change for the better, at least as we judge best along the way. How do we hold those two together? How do we both accept ourselves, including facing with acceptance and often other things such as remorse, some of the things that we've done that call us to forgiveness of ourselves? How do we face those with acceptance while at the same time not degenerating into all kinds of trouble? How do we at the same time hold ourselves to a standard and aspire and be loving and moral along the way? How do we do that? So it's a pretty big topic territory. We probably won't entirely cover it tonight. But I thought I'd start out with my usual four-point plan for everything. It's always a changing four-point plan, but anyway, I'll just offer four thoughts and see what you think about them, and then we'll take it from there. So the first thing is, of course, to be aware of what's in the way of accepting ourselves for what we are and what we are not. And what's generally in the way is one of two things: an internalized self-criticism, critic, pounder in the head, in the mind, or related to it, a fear of what will happen if we expose or reveal or act out certain parts of ourselves. So in the first case, it's one thing to see clearly and to recognize that something is skillful or not skillful, something is beneficial or not beneficial. That's prudent. That's wise to do. But what I'm talking about now is what to do with what we add to it. In a sense, the Buddha made the distinction of the first dart and the second dart that's very relevant here. The first dart, let's say, we see something in ourselves that makes us wince when we see it in a way that seems actually appropriate or true. There are things that I wince with remorse when I think of. Every single time, frankly, I think of that particular moment as a father or with a friend or as a young man or as a kid, with other people even, I wish I hadn't done it. I feel bad about it. I'm embarrassed about it. I'm ashamed of it. I feel remorseful about it. I hurt someone. I harmed someone. I acted out something in myself that should have been better regulated. And also, so that's the first dart. That's the wince of healthy remorse. There's a place for that, I think. I think that's part of being a moral species, that we can experience social emotions like remorse or guilt, or shame. On the other hand, it's different to add second darts. of beating ourselves up for it, lashing ourselves with self-criticism, punishing ourselves, grinding away about it, hurting ourselves, feeling like we're somehow defective or bad or horrible as a person. It is bad to do it to ourselves as a series of second darts, much as we can recognize that it's problematic to do it to other people. So that's what I'm talking about here. It's the second dart stuff. So two major psychological engines, if you will, of that kind of obstruction to healthy self-acceptance is, first, the internalization of criticism. We are social beings. We grow up in, you know, family environments, hopefully. We take into ourselves what is done to us, what is said to us, and then we do it to ourselves. Or through what's called social observation, we see authority figures doing it to other people. And maybe the authority figure is the big kid in nursery school, doing it to the little kids in nursery school. So we observe it over there, and we also take that into ourselves. We learn from it. We internalize it. We make it a part of ourselves. There's a lot about this that's a very natural and healthy process, but along with a lot of the good internalization of other people, their good qualities, their love, their nurturing kindness to us that we then take in and can use or draw upon to be kind and nurturing to ourselves, along with that comes a fair amount of flotsam and jetsam, depending on where you grow up. I was giving a talk one time, and this phrase is blurted out of my mouth. And then when it came out, I stopped and mentally, I had to keep talking, but thought about it later. And the phrase was, I grew up in a fault-finding home. And that's just true. It was loving. It was decent. It was protected. My parents tried. They stayed together, partly for the sake of the family. And also, it was a fault-finding home. They found fault with each other, and they really found fault with their kids. And that's the environment which I grew up in. So I have internalized some of that internalization of fault-finding, and also internalized that fear of fault being found, which then leads to a lot of preemptive strikes, as it were, of always making sure I knew the answer or was unimpeachable, nothing wrong could be found, no loose threads, right? And it's kind of a, you know, situation in which I've talked about my mom, a very, very loving person who expressed it often by helping you improve. And I've been in situations with my mom, like I'd wear a nice new shirt, and you would just see her scanning the shirt, looking for the loose thread she could mention to help me with. So to be in that environment, you know, you feel like you're on the bubble most of the time. And yeah, thanks for closing it. And we tend to do it to ourselves. It's a double-edged sword that, you know, capacity to recognize the difference between a quarter and a nickel at 200 yards, that kind of fine distinction. Well, if we could see that in other people, we can see it in ourselves as well. So one of the very first things, it's okay, it'll pass like so many things, right? It will definitely pass, okay? So the point is to be aware of that internalized critic. It takes different forms. Freud talked about the superego. There are certain beneficial aspects of it. But again, when is the internal critic, the conscience, or the part that can discern the difference between a quarter and a nickel at 200 yards, when is that part moving beyond what's useful into something that's just unnecessary pain, and in fact, harmful in other ways as well? So to be aware of that in yourself. And one of the key markers of this, which is a theme I'll talk about, is what Antonio Damasio coined the phrase somatic markers. You can get the feeling of the inner critic. Maybe you're mainly aware of the thought track, you know, or the imagery around it, but what's the body sensation of being hard on yourself? What's the associated body sensation? Because that associated body sensation tends to anchor the whole package. Body sensations, somatosensory learning is the foundation of cognition. Also, in terms of our evolution as a species, it's the most fundamental layer. It's the layer of processing and consciousness. We share with very simple animals like frogs and eels and lizards. So that layer, the sensation layer in the body that comes along with the thoughts and the images and the emotions, really tends to anchor it all in place. And so it's very important to be aware of that somatic marker. I used the metaphor earlier, I talked about this before we started, in music. A friend of mine is a musician and he plays the bass guitar. And he said that, you know, if you listen to rock and roll, it's very often the bass line that anchors the rest of the music. And I appreciate music and I'm fairly clueless about it, but after he said that, I started really paying attention to that bass beat, you know, that bass rhythm, as it were. And whether that's actually the thing that anchors, you know, music, certain kinds, whatever, but in our song of experience, right? The thought track, the emotion track, the desire track, and the action and sensation track is the last track that tends to anchor the rest of it. So being aware of the feeling in the body of being hard on yourself is really useful. And then you have opportunities to try to relax those sensations, to relax the tension, these little patterns of tension or little patterns of sensation that hold together different kinds of ways of being with ourselves that are problematic. Okay. Second aspect of this that gets in the way of self-acceptance is feeling that, you know, if I open the door to certain parts of my consciousness, or if my personality is what I really mean to say, ugly, nasty things will come out, pow, that will get an attack. And I've used a metaphor sometimes that if you can visualize it, our psyche is like a circle. That's where we start out. That's the whole estate of who we are. And then we encounter life and we do certain things. And bad stuff happens when we fill in the blank, are angry, or are goofy, or are loud, or are aggressive, or sexual, or determined, or take a chance. And whoop, bad things happen. So then we start carving out those parts of ourselves. I think of it a little bit like we're born with this vast estate, and then bit by bit by bit, many of us find ourselves in the gatekeeper's cottage, wondering why the walls feel so small. And part of the process of living is to include more and more of ourselves. To use a different metaphor, it's like the mansion of the mind. There are all these rooms that are closed off often because we're kind of creeped out by what might come out. And part of the process of self-acceptance is to start opening those doors and to be aware of the ways that we close off or don't want to reveal some of who we are. So awareness of what is disowned, what is warded off, what is denied, what is suppressed, what is not included, can really help us be more self-accepting. And one way to see that in ourselves is to think about what we push away in other people. What do we push away in other people? What bugs us? What gets on our nerves? What do we find fault with? What do we shame? What do we attack? Aha, that's a clue, a yellow flag at least. That, aha, that's probably something I push away or disown or repress in myself. And there too, we can be aware of the somatic track. The body sensation, often fairly quick, in which we suppress a part of ourselves. We push it down. There's kind of a tightening. We push it away. A lot of psychology is about what happens when we do somatic work, literally on the body itself, and then that pops the lid on lots of things that can come up and come out and be expressed. Now, as a detail, some of what we push away can be our best parts. I had this rolfing session when I was 24 or something, a long time ago, and rolfing is like deep tissue body work, and I knew how the process worked, and our rolfer was really a beast. She was intense. And, you know, it was, we were living on a beach in LA, and we swapped out a front room where she could work on people, and I hear these screams coming out of that room. Mirror, mirror, stop! No, stop! And I was like, oh my God, it's gonna hurt so much when she works on my gut. That's the fifth session, right? And in fact, as it turned out, she started to work on my gut. And then what was released was all this suppressed love. In my war with my mother, that was my great weapon, to withhold my love and disown it and push it away. And when she started working on the armoring, literally in the core of my being, all this, it was intense and wild. All this love started pouring out. And Mira, who is a very grounded, you know, she like worked on the body like someone does body work on a car. She just pounding out the dents, not an airy-fairy person at all. She literally stood at the end of the bodywork table and started feeling the energy coming off my body. And I'm not that into that stuff either myself, but I'm telling you, woof. So, we, you know, think about some of what we disown. Sometimes it's not our nasty little parts. It's often the most beautiful, generous, loving parts, joyful, exuberant, playful, alive parts of ourselves. Those two are to be included. Okay. And being aware of the sensations of what it's like to squish it away can help us start opening those doors to those rooms in the psyche. Okay. Good. Second, there's a huge strategy in Buddhism that you see very much in the early teachings and then developed later, especially in Tibetan and Zen Buddhism. And the strategy, the method to help us suffer less and rest more and more in an unconditional inner peace and happiness. The strategy is to look at experience and tease it apart as if it's a tapestry and start deconstructing it, disentangling it. To look at its different parts. So you see in Buddhist psychology these different lists that summarize different aspects of experience, such as the pure sensation itself, or whether it's pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, or what it reminds us of, or all kinds of other mental contents, or awareness itself. So the point is, when you look back on something that you're trying to forgive yourself for, like something you did wrong, if you look at it in this way, you start teasing apart its elements. What the brain does is that it indexes across individual slices of experience, you know, that are happening in fractions of a second, coherent experiences, several times at least a second. A little detail, the part of the brain that's sort of more or less like RAM, the neural basis for working memory, major part of it, upper outer frontal cortex, it updates 4 to 6 times a second. That's the refresh rate in effective experience, if you think of it. So there's a continuity to experience, but you can kind of be aware that the granularity of experience on time, it's hard to experience more than 4 or 5 things per second. If you're in an emergency situation, like falling off a rock, which I've done, a cliff, to be caught later, I'm here to tell the tale, but while you're falling, as people talk about, you know, things speed up. I suspect it's partly because the refresh rate speeds up in an emergency condition, which creates the effect of slow motion in experience. That's just a thought, but a plausible one. In any case, what the brain does is it indexes across different frames, in effect, of the movie of life, many frames per second, to find what is constant across all those frames, continuous. And then it pulls that together and turns that into a thing. In effect, we have many perceptions of a banana, but the brain goes across all those perceptions to say, oh, there's a thing that exists that's a banana. It's very effective. But this fundamental nature of cognizing can make us feel like what we did, whatever it was this big congealed lump of crud that we just can't disentangle. And so the Buddha again and again and again applies this strategy of peeling apart the elements of an experience. It's not philosophical, it's mindful. It's bringing mindfulness, including with concentration training, a kind of penetrating magnifying glass / laser into experience to see, wow, it's just all experience, all phenomenology is just made up of all these parts and threads and elements, you know, all happening. And as that felt, as the felt sense of that deepens, two things happen. One, we get less and less motivated to crave our experiences and cling to them and attach to them and struggle with them, which is liberating and freeing and helpful. And the second thing is we start feeling less afflicted by them. They don't feel so weighty. You know, they don't feel so thing-like and like we're stuck. You know? So one thing you can do, actually, is to look at something that you're embarrassed about or you feel bad about, or it's just really weighing on your heart, right? Obviously, as I talked about it last week, there are multiple things to do that lead to self-forgiveness that involve, in part, really taking responsibility, really feeling appropriate remorse, doing everything you can to make amends, clean up the mess, ask for forgiveness, and you know, don't do that again in the future, and so forth. Okay. Knowing all that, look back at what might be something that you're carrying around. You know, that time you yelled at your daughter, that time that you drove too fast and had an accident or nearly had an accident that really hurt somebody, that time when you did something related to pleasures of various kinds that looking back you don't feel good about. Whatever it might be, and I'm speaking from personal experience in all cases, when you look at it closely, try this strategy, try this method that the Buddha offered out of skillfulness of deconstructing, teasing apart, disentangling, recognizing the many, 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 many elements in what happened, and also recognizing that what happened was built from many, many distinct slices of time. So that when you tease it apart in this way, it doesn't feel so weighty and so burdensome. There's a kind of example of this that's not exact, but it gets at it. True story. I was reading an account of a monk living in Southeast Asia, I think Thailand, in a very poor setting, very little money. And this elderly monk had a tooth that was really, really hurting and needed to be pulled. But there was no dentistry in that area. So he ended up pulling it himself. And someone asked him, how did you possibly do that? Wasn't that terrifying to just anticipate the pain? And how could you ever get yourself to do that? And so here too is someone who's just taking each slice of time as itself, in its own suchness, in its own nature, without necessarily stringing it together. He said, well, no, when I knew that I would go to the garden shed, pick up a pair of pliers, wrap it around my tooth, and pull it. In that moment of knowing I would do that, there was no pain. As I lifted my left foot and took the first step toward the garden shed, there was no pain. And he just went on and on and on. It's each of these steps is the way. As I opened the door to the shed, there was no pain. As I put my hand on the pliers, there was no pain. I'll trigger a warning if you have any. It's like I'm seeing Steve Martin as a sadistic dentist. Little House of Something, horrors, I don't know. Anyway, no. So I won't do too much of the detail of this, but each step of the way you can imagine. Then he said ultimately, you know, when I placed it and pulled, there was pain. And then after that, there was no pain. And then step by step by step. And in many ways, we can look at our own experience in that way, even things that we feel that we're trying to, you know, we will always remember what happened. We will probably feel a wince of remorse when we remember it. We will use that wince of healthy remorse to guide us to a better path in the future. And we don't need to carry it around like this congealed mass. That's the second suggestion. And happily, I actually only have a 3-point plan for you tonight. The third offering is to know what it feels like to really accept, and even more than accept, actually cherish someone, to see the good in them, to love them, and to wish them well. Know what that feels like for someone that's easy. That's what that feels like. Also, here again, somatic markers. Track the body sensations. What's that feel like in the body? To just really accept them, to see them, to know they screw up, to know they do stuff, but to have a quality of acceptance and even a quality of cherishing and loving toward them. Know what that feels like, and then very actively bring it to yourself. What's that like to really accept yourself in a full way? To really, in the same way you would accept someone else. You know there's an area, there are areas for improvement. Yes, there are faults, sure to be found, and you can fully accept yourself. And even on top of that acceptance, bring a sweetness, a lovingness, a forgivingness, an easiness, a balm, like a soothing balm. You know, in the early teachings of the Buddha, there's a lot of usage of the metaphor of cooling, kind of cooling. You imagine India, you know, shade, water, cooling the fires of greed, hatred, and delusion. Cooling. To bring that to ourselves. And one of the ways into that is to recognize your common humanity, the ways you're like anyone, and that we all do dumb stuff. And so to finish here, I want to use a particular word in a moment. So one night with our kids, my wife and I, who had come up through the human potential movement in the 70s, were explaining to them, they were probably 11 and 8, somewhere like that, about that age. We were explaining to them that we had done this thing called the EST training back in like 1975, and in my case. And then we were laughing. My wife and I were really laughing. And this relates to my point here about just realizing, look, nobody's perfect. I mean, we're all perfectly imperfect, right? We all do stuff. We're humans. We're animals. Honestly, sometimes, I mean, there are two ways to look at what human beings are doing to each other and each day. You can be appalled by it, as I sometimes are, but you can also go, wow, it's amazing we're not worse. You know, you just really think about it, evolving in small hunter-gatherer bands, dying young, killing and fighting, you know, like that, you know, with our own internal lizard, mouse, and monkey, and so forth. It's amazing we're not worse. And so here comes the word. As I was getting ready to do it, you know, my wife and I were laughing, and we decided to just go for it, because we were pretty careful with our language around our kids. I said, so I don't know how exactly I put it, I said, yeah, one of the great things we learned is that we're assholes. And they were like, kids are like, what? And I said, yeah, you know, I learned I was an asshole, and you, Jan, your mother's an asshole. They're like, whoa! And I said, you too, Forrest, you're an asshole. And Laurel, and they're like, whoa. And then, yeah, you know, kind of like lightening up about it. You know what I mean? That part of it. Obviously, don't be evil, blah, 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 blah. You know, help people across the street. I don't know what. Don't steal candy from children. But, you know, the point is, look, we all mess up. And yes, we should, you know, aim higher, help ourselves, blah, 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 blah. But there is something about this recognition. Like just sort of relaxing and loosening up. Look, we're all kind of goofy. We all do weird stuff. That's part of who we are. That's part of being human. And we can bring acceptance to it as well as a sweet, cherishing spirit. Okay. All right. Questions or comments so far? I'm an asshole too. I'm still an asshole. That's the way it is. I try not to be, but I can't help it sometimes. Okay. Questions or comments so far? Great. Welcome to the evening news, yeah. Thank you very much for that. Appreciate that. Yeah, that's very, thank you very much. Thank you. Yeah, all the way.
I just wanted to say, you don't seem like an asshole to me.
Oh, thank you. Talk to my wife. No, I appreciate that. You don't either, by the way. Other people? By the way, our kids loved that. They were really okay with it. Wow, it was really cool. And they didn't misuse it either. They weren't using that word with each other. Okay. Other people? So self-acceptance, right? Great, Tom.
Just an idea. Many years ago, I had an NLP session with a practitioner, and he taught me this method of basically taking in the good and having me remember an experience where I really performed well, was acknowledged for it, and he taught me how to anchor it physically by putting my thumb, something actually it was right here.
Yeah.
And I started to feel the feeling that I had at the time when I got all this. It was an army company that all stood up and applauded me for something I was acknowledged for. And I was wondering, is there anything in reverse or that we might apply a somatic technique?
There are a lot of those great methods in a neuro-linguistic program. Programming, NLP, which summarizes a lot of very effective methods and kind of gets to the heart of it. I've learned a lot from myself. And Tom's describing this method where if we are in a good state, we're in a good place, or having a useful experience, we can deliberately anchor it by associating it to a physical sensation. And I literally have done that with my heart area, especially if there's an unobtrusive thing you can do. They don't know why you're doing it. I'm just kind of scratching this itch right here. But that's related to many experiences I have of kind of courageous heartfeltness, being strong and open. That's one way. Another thing you can do, of course, is when you are accepting yourself or bringing that cherishing sweetness to yourself, really focus on the body sensations of it. That's a way to heighten the internalization, the learning, the registration of that experience, the conversion of that experience from being simply a passing state to being increasingly acquired as a trait of self-acceptance, self-forgiveness, a sweetness applied to oneself. Yeah, very effective.
But his question, I think, was the other side of it.
Just how to apply that in the situation.
Yeah, there. Yeah, like that. Now, if you're talking about releasing, you're talking about now releasing. That's really, it's a great question, right? How do you release the tip of the root, the somatic tip of the root, let's say?
Come back to my breath.
Yeah, or of like self-criticism or harshness. Yeah, and one thing I see that's very useful about that is to do what I call linking. Other people use this method as well, where you're aware of two things at the same time. You're not just, nothing wrong with it, but you're not simply observing it mindfully. You are deliberately associating something positive that's a natural match or antidote to the negative. So let's say you have the feeling in your body of like beating yourself up, or let's say I'll just pull it right up, like that kind of shrinking and trying to not let mommy get mad at me. I can feel that in my body like that. It's learning, right? We're designed to learn, especially negative experiences in childhood, right? So what do you do with that, right? One thing to do with it is to think, okay, I'm aware of it, I got it, but what's a natural antidote? Because it's hard to release things just by observing them, because the brain is slow to change, especially negative learning. So you can do what I call linking. I have a lot of freely offered material about this. It summarizes this general method in which, let's say, you're aware of the negative, including, let's say, the body sensations of it. I could feel it in my body right now, avoiding, getting off the radar, whatever. You think, okay, what's the opposite of that? Well, it's someone who really appreciates me, really accepts me. Really says, hey, Rick, swing, man. Take a swing. It's okay. You might strike out. No big. Get another swing. What up? Something like that. Kind of loving, accepting. Maybe I could load heavily on female authority figures. That would be really matched to that old, neurotic contraction, right? And so then if you're simply aware of two things at once, and you find the details of this, and it's usually pretty quick, half a minute or less, you're aware of two things at once, keep the positive bigger. You want it to purify the negative. You don't want the negative to contaminate, quote unquote, the positive. Right? So you're aware of two things at once, a few breaths in a row or even longer, that naturally deconditions or counterconditions in very understandable and well-researched ways that negative material. takes repetition usually. Sometimes you get a complete release, but it usually with repetition you can really make a change. And that's a very, very, very powerful thing to do. Okay? Anybody else? Great, one last person. Two last people. First Diane, yeah. Great.
So with some of the examples of the positive that you've given have been very sweet and loving. And I'm just curious if you're trying to ensure, and I'm thinking of a friend like this, that they're not cringing and feeling small and beating themselves up internally. Does it work for them to tap into a time when they were feeling very powerful?
Oh, yeah.
And in other words, it's not necessarily sweetness. It's it's more, you know, sheer strength.
Sure, definitely. I think there are pitfalls in most everything, but that doesn't mean we should not walk the path. So on the one hand, there are pitfalls in being too passive with our own mind. And I think sometimes people use mindfulness as a way to just be passive with the mind, which is not what the Buddha taught. He was really quite clear and offered many ways to engage wise effort. On the other hand, there is a pitfall in over-manipulating the mind and chasing and getting attached to certain therapeutically clever methods. I could speak about that from experience. And, you know, to me, we want to kind of have a wisdom place where we feel what there is to feel. Often it just passes on its own. But if it persists as a kind of habit of mind, then it's nice to know that we've got tools in our toolbox, that we can use actively to help free ourselves from that affliction, from the weight of that, which often reaches back to when we were very, very young, even pre-verbally. Last person, then we'll wrap up. Great.
Maybe this is an example. You can tell me if it is. I was with my sister last week, and for a week, and we had a really difficult interaction. And we were in the middle of this very difficult interaction, and I could feel her anger and my frustration and my anger. And all of a sudden, something in me said, "You love this person. You really love this person."
Yeah.
And so at that point, I was so angry and hurt, and also the love was kind of taking over.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering if this was a living example of allowing in that, all that's good in the relationship and good in my heart, allowing that to sort of take this part and just kind of like, and let that.
It's a beautiful example. And for me, it's really quite visceral. And again, what's the feeling of it in the body? It's not, in my view, it's not enough to simply witness the mind or release things. We need to replace what we release. And it even can have that feeling of something cooling, you know, dialing down something hot or something soothing. Or for me, it even is almost like something sliding underneath it and uprooting that weed, in effect, in that way you're describing. Yeah, that's very powerful. And the question or the topic here is to bring that to yourself. You know, where you really, you face it, but you know yourself better than anyone else in the world. You know how hard it's been for you. You know what you've struggled with. You know how it's been tough. You know what's landed on you. You know the, like the tin cans behind a newly married couple that are behind the car, you know the stuff that you've been hauling around with you, right? You know it. And out of really knowing it, you can find tremendous kindness and support and blessing for yourself. How about we sit for a minute and finish up? Thank you very much. Take good care. See you next week.
Thank you.